This free program is paid for by the listeners of WBAI New York. If you're not already a member, think about joining us to help keep free speech alive.
Today on Women, Body, and Soul, we'll hear from What About Our Daughters blogger and radio correspondent Gina McCauley and her open letter to Concord Black women. Then join us for an interview with the esteemed Bell Hooks, cultural critic, feminist theorist, and renowned author of more than 20 books. We'll discuss Ms. Hooks' latest book, Teaching Critical Thinking, and much more on Women, Body, and Soul with your host, Natalie Tandiwe, WBAI Pacifica Radio, 99.5 FM, streaming live online at WBAI.org. Stay tuned.
Have I got news for you? Something. I hope you think that you're something too.
So shake your shimmy, sister, 'cause honey, the sugar is feeling fine.
This is Gina McCauley from the blog What About Our Daughters. Harriet Tubman is often quoted as having said, "I freed 1,000 slaves, but I could have freed 1,000 more if only they knew they were slaves." These days, I kind of know what Harriet Tubman must have felt each time she risked her life to travel back into slave territory to free more slaves, only to have to leave behind those who refused to leave the comfort of captivity. For the past 3 weeks, my readers and I have been voicing objections to controversial statements made by MSNBC contributor Teray. For the past 3 weeks, my readers have been demanding a public statement from MSNBC President Phil Griffin. That's not asking for much in light of the fact that MSNBC has issued such statements in the past. But one group of intrepid souls has taken time to wade into my blog's comments section to tell us that we should shut up, that we are asking for too much. Some have even asked us how dare we think that we were important enough to raise an objection or expect a response. One commenter, Kitty, said, quote,
"The reason that this man has not responded is that he simply does not care. Why should he? Black women are going to continue to tune into MSNBC regardless of the hurtful and offensive content of their programming and statements made by their employees. Oh, we fume and we continue to watch, so why should he say anything? A few telephone calls is not going to make him apologize." End quote.
Some more profane ruminations ended up in the spam folder. At first, I was angry with these people. I mean, if you don't want to object, fine. Shut up and get out of the way of people who do want to lodge an objection. And then it hit me one day as I was reading a comment from someone who called herself Sharla. Instead of anger, I just began to feel tremendous pity. Sharla said,
"And who are you supposed to be? Important? You think anyone at MSNBC is going to care enough of a grain of salt?"
End quote. I felt tremendous pity that Sharla would think so little of herself, that she would believe that no one would ever listen to her, and therefore no one would ever listen to me. Sharla, you see, has been conquered. And so, I would like to send this dispatch out to all of the conquered black women of the world running around trying to get freed black women to shut up. Dear conquered black woman, I am sorry that you feel small, that you dream small, live small, and will die small. Conquered black woman, I'm sorry you feel powerless. I'm sorry that you feel your opinion is of no consequence and that you are voiceless. I am sorry that you view your life as one series of obstacles which you can never overcome. Therefore, I should never bother to try to overcome any of my own. I'm sorry that when you see me and other black women raising our voices in objection to being marginalized, dehumanized, disrespected, and abused, you, oh conquered black woman, The only time you appear to be able to raise your voice is in an effort to tell me to quiet my own. I cannot. I will not. Because while I may feel sorry for your plight, and I may weep for the life you could have lived if only you had been brave enough to grasp it, I cannot, O conquered black woman, stay with you on the plantation of pitifulness, the island of ignorance, or jump in with you into the abyss of apathy. Yes, conquered black woman, you used to make me angry. I used to want to change your mind, argue with you, fight for you when you wouldn't bother fighting for yourself. But this fighting thing, it's kind of getting old. And I have to conserve my energy. Fighting with you in order to get you to consider fighting for yourself just can't be at the top of my priority list right now. Much like Harriet Tubman couldn't drag every slave she encountered kicking and screaming into free territory, O conquered black woman, I cannot drag you away kicking and screaming from your very own conquered mind. But may I make one small request? The next time you see a freed black woman raising her God-given voice to exercise her God-given right to object to anything, large, small, or infinitesimally small, please, please, O conquered black woman, take the opportunity to do what you do best. Remain silent. P.S. O conquered black woman, we got our statement from MSNBC at 12:43 this afternoon. That one's for you, Kitty, and for you too, Sharla. This has been Gina McCauley from the blog WhatAboutOurDaughters.com, and thank you for having me once again here on Women, Body, and Soul.
That was Women, Body, and Soul correspondent Gina McCauley. To join her and other free blacks in their protest of MSNBC's continued brand support of Tory's even after his inappropriate conjecture regarding the rape of enslaved black women, see whataboutourdaughters.com for further information and the contact number for the office of MSNBC President Phil Griffin in order to express your concerns. Our guest today on Women, Body, and Soul is author, thinker, teacher, and foremost theorist on race, gender, and justice, the one and only Bell Hooks. Her first book, Ain't I a Woman? Black Women and Feminism in 1981, which she began when she was 19, was named one of the 20 most influential women's books of the last 20 years by Publishers Weekly in 1992. A prolific writer, Hooks has published many critically acclaimed and influential books on the politics of race, gender, class, and culture, including Black Looks, Talking Back, Communion, The Female Search for Love, Where We Stand, Class Matters, The Will to Change, Men, Masculinity, and Love, Feminism is for Everybody, Passionate Politics, Teaching Critical Thinking, Practical Wisdom, and All About Love, New Visions. Celebrated as one of our nation's leading public intellectuals by the Atlantic Monthly, as well as one of Uttney Reader's 100 Visionaries Who Could Change Your Life, she divides her time among teaching, writing, and lecturing around the world. Welcome to Women, Body, and Soul in Pacifica Radio New York City, Bell Hooks.
Thank you for having me.
It's exciting to have you. I put out some posts on Facebook, and people are very excited that you're going to be on the air with us today, so welcome to the Pacifica family. I don't want to get the number of books wrong. Can you tell us how many books you've published?
Well, I can't because I often don't include the children's books, and so
okay.
I think more than 20 is enough.
Okay, you know? I didn't want you to think. Well, she didn't bother to find out, so we'll leave it at more than 20. But you are what people would happily call prolific in terms of your publishing. Your most recent publication is Teaching Critical Thinking, Practical Wisdom. It's now third in what stands as a trilogy on teaching that began with Teaching to Transgress, Education as the Practice of Freedom, followed by Teaching Community of Pedagogy of Hope. How does Teaching Critical Thinking further complement the first two works on teaching?
Well, Teaching Critical Thinking is unusual for me in the sense that it isn't a book of long essays. It really is a response to 50 questions that 50 different people really wanted me to answer different questions about teaching. Like, you know, a black woman colleague wanted me to write about How do you maintain authority as a black woman in the classroom without being made to be perceived as the angry black woman? And so it was a fun book to write in that sense because the topics vary so.
Mm. I'm curious, how do you define critical thinking?
Well, I think that, you know, I like to think of critical thinking as sort of a basic asking the who, what, when, where, why questions as a sort of jump off for critical thinking.
Mm.
Because it gets you, your mind moving and going forward. And it's a way of understanding critical thinking that is accessible to many people.
That is actually a really great and simple way to start, because I was sitting eating lunch and reading your book a few days ago, and a gentleman was sitting next to me, and he saw the title. And, of course, that was one of his first questions, and so we got into a discussion about critical thinking. And I found that as we kind of were unpacking the term and kind of going through the layers, and I thought, this seems so complicated trying to express what this is. And I love the way you put it into kind of the five W's, the who, what, when, where, why. It makes it much more simple and accessible for people. One of the things that you say in the book is that we often blunt children's innate critical thinking passion in our educational emphasis on conformity and obedience. I'm wondering what recommendations you have for supporting children in their critical thinking.
Well, I think especially for children from backgrounds that are disadvantaged economically, often in because parents are overworked or busy, or that very heart of critical thinking, which is questioning. You know, one of the things that I say it's in the book is that it's answering questions, utilizing the knowledge in a manner that enables you to determine what matters most. And I think that many of us have watched a certain kind of parenting in our lives as African Americans, where you're really shut down when you begin to ask questions. I don't think that that's just African Americans, but I actually feel at times that African Americans overvalue obedience in parenting, and that's one of the things that begins to shut off that will to be a critical thinker, you know, to analyze and evaluate.
That's an interesting point. I remember another mother shared an article with me, I think it was from the New York Times, about an analysis of kind of intellectual freedom among children from different classes. And one of the things they looked at is the level of comfort children had with asking questions and resistance. And the study found that children from working class families were much less likely to be comfortable asking questions or resisting authority, because that value in a working class environment on what you call conformity and obedience and following the rules was so heavily reinforced. Whereas children in higher socioeconomic brackets had a reinforcement of questioning authority consistently, and also asking questions and resisting.
And as African American and people of color children, we often get a mixed message. In my family, I got the message that education was really important, but when I asked too many questions, I was deemed crazy, especially questions that my parents felt were inappropriate.
Yeah, I think that's, I know there are some interesting conversations going on that I've seen with various Facebook groups and on Twitter about this issue of what is it that we are reinforcing in our children, particularly in the African American community, around these issues of obedience and conformity, and how do we respond to children when they are what is called disobedient, and also when they ask a lot of questions. So I think these are, it's good to see that people are beginning to discuss these, but there are definitely things that I was curious about your thoughts on. One of the things that I noticed is that, you know, you talk about critical thinking, but it's, you know, we're talking about it in this book in the context of the classroom, but what I've seen among adults kind of at all ends of the political spectrum is that there's a decided lack of critical thinking in general. And it's not specific to your politics. It's probably cultural. And I'm wondering, how can we stimulate the critical thinking muscle in adults who don't actively seek out the practice?
Well, one of the teaching tools that I think is a part of everyday life that we all use to learn is conversation. And just engaging people with people in lively, provocative conversation is one way to stimulate critical thinking. For example, I mean, people across class, cross race, lots of people have had conversations about the movie Precious, and I think it has stimulated for a lot of people critical thinking about issues that go beyond the movie or that were barely touched upon in the movie.
And I'm curious, I do want to ask you more questions about the book, but since you did bring up Precious, I'm curious, would you be willing to share with us some of your thoughts on the dialogue that has been going on about the movie or about the actress Gabby Sidibe and some of the response that people have had to her presence in Hollywood?
Well, my major concern is that I do not feel this movie was a film about incest. It made use of the same kinds of things that Hollywood has ever always made use of, sex, violence, and fantasy. One thing that really deeply concerned me when I went back to Sapphire's novel, Push, which I also think is not a particularly well-written novel, is that there weren't all the white people in the novel that are present in the movie that are just make up this whole world of fantasy. Mm. And I just think that it's very disturbing. I was re-looking at Tyler Perry's Madeira's Family Reunion, which also deals with the issue of incest, but it's a much more sophisticated dealing because there's a processing between mother and daughter and other people that are affected, her sister. And in many ways, Precious was like melodrama in that you got sort of these key melodramatic moments. I think it's so significant that Monique, who is this character, is the person that gets a big award because that character who embodied the violence, the rage, really draws your emotional attention in the film much more than Precious, because Precious is a pretty one-dimensional character in the film. No highs, no lows, really. Whereas the character that Monique plays really, I think, excited viewers in the classic ways that villains have excited viewers in Hollywood. Mm-hmm. But I don't think the film did a great deal to really teach people or show people the damaging trauma of incest.
Mm. I'm curious, one of the other conversations that I've been seeing about Precious is the kind of after conversation about Gabby Sidibe and what her presence as, in particular, the focus on her weight and what her presence in Hollywood means for black people and an incredible obsession around critiquing her weight. What are some of your thoughts about that conversation?
Well, I mean, we all know that there has always, Hollywood has always made use of an overweight black female to fill certain roles, and she rarely has that female a prolonged career. Because how many times can you produce the so-called mammy role? I mean, the thing is, we know that black females are among the most obese in this country. And the fact is, again, the film makes use of that, exploits that trope, but there's no discussion in the film at all. There's all this interjection of stuff that's not in the book, mm-hmm. but there's no interjection of a relationship between her weight gain and the trauma that the character Precious has mm-hmm. experienced, the role that food plays. It's always very sad when these kinds of popular culture things actually do more to advance the very thing that they claim to be bringing into awareness. And I think that I feel very much like there won't be very many roles for Gabby, as there have never been very many roles for black women in general, but particularly her size, her color. The fact is there are many, many gorgeous, large, sexy, softic black women, and I don't find that Gabby to be one of them myself. But I think that that's something else that we're not even allowed to talk about. Why did they choose this particular young woman? You know, she fit a certain kind of stereotype in the minds of a lot of people of black girl, victim. And, you know, and I've said, and I've done a long piece on Precious, that in fact most people who suffer incest are not this kind of stereotype that I think a lot of people have of what the victim is. And so I would hope for Gabby that she thinks about going to college and furthering herself much as Precious needed to do, because I don't think that Hollywood would be a place where she should place her hope for the future.
Mm, Interesting. And is your piece on Precious, is it something that's already published and that other people can take a look at?
It is, and I just finished it with a black woman filmmaker, and we're just going to put it on the Internet, but I don't have the information yet.
Okay, we'll follow that, and I'll post that on Facebook when you have it. one of the things in teaching critical thinking that you talk about is conflict. And this whole notion that there is a deep aversion to conflict. And I'm curious, how can we have constructive conflict in the classroom and in community rather than kind of getting stuck in notions about safety and the need to avoid conflict?
Well, I think that one of the basic ways to think about constructive conflict is to try to move away from right and wrong. Because when people have a deep investment in I'm right, you're wrong, there tends to be a competitive, combative element that happens in dialogue. And if we promote the idea that part of dialogue and discussion of difference is to understand the other person's point of view, I always like the part in therapies I've been in the past where you're asked to state what the other person is saying. Because so often when we get engaged in conflict, especially if we're, quote, fighting to win, we actually don't even hear what the other person is saying. And so I think that cultivating that quality of listening that is also, I think, a gesture of care and love helps us to have difficult conversations where conflicts may arise but that are compassionate and clear.
One of the things that that you talk about is the de-radicalization of black studies, women's studies, and cultural studies. What does that mean?
Well, I think what it means is that anytime you have a corporate system like of education where ideas come into a system and people are rewarded, I think what has happened is that whole sense of these programs that came into being out of radical action for people wanting to change curriculum, change ways of thinking, then as they get more institutionalized into the academy, they become like, oh, if you want that, go get that. But we haven't really changed the core curriculum and the core ways people think about specific ideas. And so to some extent, then women's studies courses, like every women's studies course I know grapples with, often we're teaching the students who already have a great deal of the information we have because we have a hard time attracting people who don't want to know those ideas or haven't had a sense that those ideas are relevant to their experience. And the same has been true for black studies, that oftentimes black studies courses would just be taken by black students or with the rare other student of color or white student who shows an interest. And I think it's about right now trying to, one, keep these programs alive and departments at colleges and universities, but also to find ways to encourage everyone to recognize that black studies is as relevant to their own intellectual growth or academic growth as other fields of study.
You write and publish what's usually referred to as prolifically, and I can only imagine that this takes time in solitude. And I'm wondering, how do you deal with dynamics like isolation and loneliness and the need for time alone, but balance that with self-care and community and relationships?
Well, I have to be frank that I didn't deal with that very well, I think, early on. I'm 57 now. I didn't deal with that, I think, very well in my 30s. And like many, many black females, I really overworked, and it had a very negative impact on my health. And I think that what I learned as I looked around and saw so many black women thinkers, especially dissident thinkers, becoming ill or actually dying early, I thought, oh, I need to examine my life and see what's happening here. And one of the key things that was missing in my life was, in fact, balance. And I think it's often missing in the lives of black females in general, but especially the busier you are, the more well-known you are, the demands that people place on you. And often I think that dissident black women, I think of June Jordan, I think of Toni K. Bambara, that we don't come home to the renewal resources that other people may have all the time of a constant partner or functional family. All of those things are community of support. So I think that what happened to me as my health, I began to have health problems, was really looking around me at the fate of Black women thinkers and writers and really deciding that I needed to create a different plan for my life that was holistic, that would actually start with the question of health and how much time in a given day will I give myself to meditate, to take care of the self. And what I find continually is how angry people get when I don't make myself available in a simple way. And I think that it's very gendered, because I don't think for a minute that people think that if they want to approach Cornel West, they're like going to get in touch with him right away, right, and he's going to respond. But people get really irate,
yes,
if I don't respond immediately to their needs. And I, of course, link it to, you know, our whole sense of women as mothers. And I think all women teachers and in professions that require some element of caregiving run the risk of people expecting us to sort of martyr ourselves and to give and to give and to give without self-care. You know, and I'm fond of telling my students, first love is self-love, that you really need to take care of mind, body, spirit, heart. And I think that that, for me, is about balance. It's about recognizing the time that one needs. I mean, even talking to you today, my mom died about 6 days ago.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that.
But I really felt like I needed to take time for myself to be quiet. So I didn't want to answer the phone and talk with people. I wanted to be in meditation and prayer. But again, I just got so much hostility from people because they couldn't reach me.
Yeah.
And I think that to some extent technology has made this even worse, because everybody thinks that, oh, you should be accessible through cell phones, email, what have you. And so it's really hard to, I think continually hard for women and for Black women in particular to take the time that we need to have that balanced sense of ourselves.